Disculpe, estoy buscando desde el librero.
¡Sigue! ¡Sigue! ¡Capitán Nemo! El mundo no precisa de nuevos continentes, sino de hombres nuevos.
Beneficio reprochado, ofensa hecha.
Uno para todos y todos para uno.
La bravura siempre es respetada, incluso en un enemigo.
¡Sigue! ¡Ale, ale!
Gracias, D'Artagnan.
Nada era del individuo, a no ser unos cuantos centímetros cúbicos dentro de su cráneo. El gran hermano es la concreción de que el partido se presenta al mundo. Su función es actuar como punta de mira para todo. ¡Sigue ahora que puedes!
Divide tu día en partes y a cada una asígnale una tarea. Sin dejar un cuarto de hora, 10 minutos, ni 5 siquiera sin algo que hacer. Cuando sea así, observarás que no necesitas compañía, conversación ni simpatía de nadie. Y lograrás vivir con la independencia que todo ser humano debe aspirar. Gracias, señorita Jane Eyre.
Sigue leyendo, sigue escuchando. Esto es Desde el Librero, un podcast de Librerías Gandhi. Bienvenidos, queridos lectores.
Queridos amigos, ¿cómo están? Yo soy Yara Vidal y estamos de plácemes porque el día de hoy vamos a escuchar una entrevista que le realicé a Julia Quinn justo cuando salió su serie Bridgerton en Netflix. Ella es autora de 19 novelas consecutivas y todas en la lista de los libros más vendidos de New York Times, traducidas a 42 idiomas. Julia está más que consolidada como autora de romance para jóvenes y no tan jóvenes. Ella vendió su libro, el primer libro, a los 24 años. Desde entonces no ha parado de contar historias de las familias, de generaciones, con especial énfasis en personajes femeninos que encuentran modos de hacer lo mejor posible en circunstancias históricas y sociales que eran súper restrictivas. Si bien ya era una escritora reconocida, su popularidad se disparó en el 2020 cuando la serie basada en sus novelas se estrenó en Netflix. Platicamos con ella por la celebración de estas 19 novelas gracias a Editorial Urano en español, y lo que van a escuchar en estos programas es esta entrevista que sostuve con ella en el 2021, y la siguiente semana van a escuchar la entrevista que hicimos con ella hace un par de meses. Y por supuesto, vamos a tener la sección de Mariana Aguilar, Horrores de Redactores. ¡Comenzamos!
Desde el Librero presenta Horrores de Redactores. ¿Alguna vez te han regañado por decir he imprimido? Cuando decimos algo como ya terminé mi tarea, pero no la he imprimido, suele intervenir alguien para corregirnos. No se dice imprimido, se dice impreso, pero tal vez no tenga razón. Hoy en Horrores de Redactores vamos a descubrir por qué. El participio es una forma no personal de los verbos, que se caracteriza por las terminaciones ado, ido, do, so, cho. Por ejemplo, cantado, comido, escrito, impreso, dicho. El participio pertenece a una categoría de las palabras a la que de manera informal le llamamos verboides. Estos, básicamente, son los zombies de los verbos. Me explico. Se trata de verbos que dejan de serlo a medias para adquirir una nueva función. El participio del que estamos hablando es una forma del verbo que también funciona como adjetivo. Por ejemplo, pollo asado, pan comido, lenguaje escrito, libro impreso o mal dicho. Estos modificadores están en participio. Para recordar un poquito, los adjetivos son esa categoría de las palabras que nos ayuda a modificar a los sustantivos, describirlos o especificarlos. Entonces podemos utilizar el participio tanto con su función de verbo, he buscado, fue publicado, ha muerto, como en su versión de adjetivo, los criminales más buscados, libros recién publicados o lenguas muertas, no moridas. Oigan, pero regresemos a nuestra pregunta inicial. ¿Se dice imprimido o impreso? Bueno, el verbo imprimir, al igual que el verbo freír o bendecir, tiene dos participios posibles. El regular, imprimido, freído y bendecido, y el irregular, impreso, frito y bendito. Cuando utilizamos el participio como parte de una construcción verbal, es decir, como verbo, podemos utilizar el regular. Hemos imprimido 5.000 ejemplares de este libro. Este pescado fue freído en aceite de oliva o el sacerdote ha bendecido a los fieles. Así como el irregular. Hemos impreso 5.000 ejemplares, el pescado fue frito en aceite de oliva. Ambas variantes son válidas. Solo bendecir representa una excepción, porque no podemos decir el Papa ha bendito a sus seguidores. Pero eso sí, cuando utilizamos el participio como adjetivo, en los casos de imprimir, freír y bendecir, siempre debemos emplear su variante irregular. Texto impreso, pollo frito y agua bendita. Por eso me llama la atención cuando veo mensajes en los que nos desean un bendecido día. Según esta regla, lo adecuado sería bendito. Así que ya saben, muchos de nuestros adjetivos provienen de verbos que se trasladan al participio, en sus terminaciones regulares e irregulares. Ado, ido, to, so, cho. Complicado, amado, vendido, reducido, abierto, resuelto, visto, hecho. Cuéntenos qué otros se les ocurren y nos vemos en la próxima emisión de Horrores de Redactores.
Y ahora, la entrevista con Julia Quinn.
Julia, thank you so much for this time that you're sharing with us this afternoon. How are you?
I'm great. I'm telling you, I'm missing Mexico, though. I usually go to Mexico several times per year, and I haven't been able to, so I'm really missing you guys.
Where do you usually go?
I go to Nuevo Vallarta. I write a lot of my books there, actually.
Wow, that's good. So each saga has a little bit of sand and piña coladas and so
margarita,
on.
Margarita, some guacamole, yeah. There's a little bit of Mexico in all of my books.
Well, hopefully... Maybe at the end of the year or starting the next year.
I would very much, yeah.
So let's talk about the Duke and I. It's 21 years now since you wrote that magical, groundbreaking book it's how many generations now? Because you have many, you can have mom, grandmother, and daughter sharing your stories. So how has it changed since the first time it was published?
Well, I don't know that the book has changed, but it for me, it's kind of surreal because, I mean, so in the United States, for example, our drinking age is 21. So I joke that like my book can finally drink now, you know, it's, and it's, to see it suddenly become this worldwide thing. I mean, it had been very popular for a romance novel. It had done very well. It was, you know, many people loved it. But then all of a sudden, now the whole world has discovered it and the whole family in a way that I never dreamed possible. And it's just so crazy because I wrote it so long ago. And, you know, so many people ask me, well, where did you get the idea for the Bridgertons? And Alex says, I don't remember. I wrote it in 1998.
Yeah, it's a lifetime apart.
It's a long time ago. But I guess, you know, romance and love stories are timeless. I don't know.
So you're a really good reader of the, I don't know, Jane Austen novels. And mm-hmm. then something struck and then you found that story inside of it.
Yeah, you know, people often ask me, you know, they say, well, what made you want to be a writer? And it's really, I love to read. And I think it's like that for any writer. I mean, not every reader becomes a writer, but all writers are big readers, I think. And so I just think it made sense that what I would want to write would be what I really enjoyed reading for fun, which were these romances set in the Regency or, you know, for the way I often explain it to people is the Jane Austen time period, because a lot of people don't know the term the Regency. And they were fun and they were romantic and they were far enough in the past that they were kind of like a fairy tale, you know, fantasy in some ways. And, you know, even though you wouldn't want to live in that time period, it was so much fun to read about it. And I just really enjoyed reading it. It was what I had did for fun. And so I think it just made sense that that's what I would try to my hand when I was writing. And luckily for me, it worked out really well. It's a time period that works well for my writing strengths, I think.
Now, as you said, the whole world has fallen in love with this story, thanks to obviously you, but the association with Shonda Rhimes. Mm-hmm. And how magical was it for you to see the beautiful clothing? I mean, obviously the inspiration comes from you, but when you finally see that adaptation with all the changes and you know, it's really crazy. And we had this gift for Christmas in a time that people really needed it, you know, through this crazy time.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing about Bridgerton is that it's a show that really celebrates human connections, whether it's romantic or family or friendship. That's what's at the heart of it. And it came at a time when I think people were really missing that, because we've been by ourselves for so long. So the timing was really quite fortuitous. But in terms of seeing the adaptation, I mean, I got to visit the set before I actually saw the show. So I had some hints. I knew what some of this was going to look like. So I had already had my wow moment. Although you still get a wow moment when you see the whole show, but you know, they actually filmed me walking onto the set the first time. I mean, they had their hands over my eyes because they didn't want me to see it right away. And I was just, you can't believe it, because, well, the first time I visited, they were on location. So they were filming outside, but the second time it was in the soundstage where they'd built this entire world, and it's huge. I mean, it is absolutely enormous. You can't even imagine. I mean, the inside of the building is 3 or 4 stories high. I mean, there are entire carriages inside, and you see, you know, all of a sudden you walk in and you're just like in Featherington House. And then you walk over here and it's Daphne's bedroom, and people are walking by and they're in these incredible clothes. And I mean, it's really unbelievable. And not anything I ever thought was going to happen in my career, I have to be honest. So it's just been a delight.
It's a great, like good, like dharma, you know, to have that good luck, to have that gift for you after all the suffering. Because I know that authors suffer so much for their art. It's really difficult. You don't know if you're going to find your readers. It's going to get printed, let alone find a good reader, not a good fan base and so on. So I'm happy for you.
Honestly, it's been such a Cinderella story for me, because not only was it adapted, but it was adapted so well. And every step of the way, it's just been wonderful. I mean, I haven't had a moment where I've been like, you know, it's just like every time something could go right, it did. Mm-hmm. And so it's just been, you know, people will sometimes come to me, other authors, saying, well, can you give me some advice about getting something adapted? And I'll be like, no, because, you know, I didn't have to do anything. It was just everything fabulous just kept happening. I feel like I'm the most boring interview, because all I ever say is, everything's awesome.
No, thank God. No, you don't want someone who's saying like, I don't like it. I much prefer to see you happy, a reader soul. So mm-hmm. I mean, get the good energy going and sharing it. So that's really good. Now I would like to talk about the female desire in this saga. Because, for example, I love Madame Bovary, and I know it's a different time period, but just the part of knowing that in these stories the women have like a constant space where the desire, if not the desire quite as clear, but you have it with certain characters. There's a moment where you, or probably readers, get the notion that we didn't have that liberty, and it's something that we have been gaining on along generation through generation. So how do you start that dialogue with the female desire in your novel?
Well, I think you have to start out being very aware of what society was then. And what were the norms? What was allowed to women? What were they allowed to be? What was their, you know, accepted place in society? And then I start thinking, okay, well, who, you think about your characters, like, is this somebody who's going to be like really busting out of all of the societal norms? Or is this somebody who is like quietly pushing against it? So you have somebody like Eloise, who is like, you know, waving the flag, being like, hey. And then you have somebody like Daphne, who is much more quiet about it, but is still very much trying to find her place, trying to find out, you know, saying like, wait a minute, I should have control over some of these aspects in my life. You know, maybe she's not the one out there trying to get into university before they accept women, but she is suddenly like, hey, I am my own person. I should be able to decide who I marry. I should be able to decide certain things. And so I really like to celebrate the women who help make the way for the people who are waving the flag. I think, you know, we can't all be that person at the front of the parade. But the person at the front of the parade needs all these other women behind her, helping her. And so I will often write about the helpers, the people who wouldn't make the history books, but their quiet choices, their decisions to try to take control in their own life help set the stage for other people to make big societal change. And I think it's really important to celebrate those people too, to remind everyone that, yeah, we should be honoring and celebrating the trailblazers and the people who maybe we'll read about in the history books, but the people who are standing up for them and are helping them along the way are also very important and deserve celebration.
Exactly. And in this time, it's the most important time for us because in our present, we have to, as you said, take the trailblazers to in the center of the stage. But also thinking that it's your own story. You should be the trailblazer in your own life. And don't forget, because even if we think we can vote, we can have children and be CEOs and all of that, but women's desire, it's so, I don't know, so fragile in a way, because women usually live through others. Like we're thinking probably with the husband, with the father, with the someone else, but what do you want? And I have come across people, friends, maybe you also, like it may be 15 when they're teenagers or 20 years old or 60. And if you ask a woman if they're living their true desire of the life they want to live, the sexual life they want to live, and so on, it's something that's not so common to say, yeah, I live just the way I want, the life that I have imagined.
Well, that's one thing I think that the television show does incredibly well is show that side of life from the female perspective. And it's very interesting to me because, you know, whenever I see somebody write about Bridgerton in the press, it's always like, oh, the racy show, the raunchy show, the sexy show. And I'm always a little curious about it because there's so many shows on television that are just as explicit as Bridgerton. The difference is in Bridgerton, they're showing sex and intimacy between people who care about each other, where sex is romantic and not transactional, where it is. And then they're also showing it from the female point of view, as opposed to the male point of view. I mean, if you look at the show, there actually isn't a whole lot of nudity in it, but what there is, it's of the men.
Exactly. Really,
you know, and suddenly like all the men who are writing about the show are like, oh, this is so racy. This is so raunchy. I'm like, well, that's because, you know, we're getting to see, you know, the things, not Daphne. You know, you're used to having the camera on, you know, the women in a way that makes them objects. Well, suddenly, you know, we get to see the men, maybe not as objects, but we're holding the camera for once. And I think that
super important.
It is super important, but I think it maybe doesn't make people uncomfortable, but it makes them suddenly think, oh, this is so racy, where it's like, well, would you consider it that racy if it was done from the male gaze? Maybe not, just because we're used to it.
Mm-hmm. Probably the same thing happened to the Outlander series.
Mm-hmm.
And what I love about those books and the adaptation is also that the story is told from a female point of view, and not many historical figures are able to tell the story like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I do think it's important to have the male point of view too, because it is a romance, and it's a heterosexual romance. So there are, you know, men and women, but I mean, we're just so used to having all of our art given to us by the men, not just like making it, but saying like, this is what you should watch it. You know, this is what we're going to study in school. This is what we're going to nominate for awards. This is what art is. And also this is what entertainment is. They are the ones deciding, you know, look how long we had to go before we got a superhero movie with a woman in the.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I just think it's great suddenly to have a show that values women, the women's point of view, but also happiness.
Mm-hmm.
And don't get me wrong, I love the shows that, you know, are edgy and dark and mysterious and stuff, but we don't get a lot of television shows that are about happiness, where that's the goal. And we, in our society, we tend to value for art and entertainment things that aren't about happiness. It's like,
I hate it.
Yeah. It's like, okay, well, let's give the awards to all the sad things.
Mm-hmm.
Let's
all the books. Yeah. Most of the books are it's all the time, the killing, the life is horrible. Society is the worst, and so on and so on. And we're getting programmed in a way to.
Yeah. And then when you write a romance novel, somebody says, well, that's not realistic. And I'm like, what? People fall in love every day.
Exactly.
How is this book about a serial killer? I mean, I hope mine's more realistic than that one. I mean, I hope mine's more common at least.
We normalize tragedy.
Yeah. When I think I would love to normalize happiness.
I'm with you.
We need to get drinks next time I make it to Mexico.
Yes, I'll meet you there and I'll bring the whatever books you want. Then, so you don't have to, I mean, I can drive and get the books and you just start looking for the next idea for your next saga and so on. No, but I think it's really important what you're saying. And I'm glad that we're having that conversation because, as you say, the male point of view is that dictating how we should look, how a normal life or a normal job and so on. So all the new voices are just like trying to catch on and say, wait, exactly as you said, like people are usually, I mean, for example, as you know, in Berlin, the artists are really out there, you know, mm-hmm. they're, and people, I was there for a summer and you can find different expressions of art. For example, David Bowie, made a super album there and he stayed some time and so on. And today it made the news that there's a doctor who's an heterosexual who dresses to work with women's, I mean, the first part, the upper part is normal clothes. It's male clothes. Mm-hmm. And on the underneath, he uses dresses and like big heels and so on. So, and if people are still becoming enraged of how femininity can come across many different people. It's so mind-boggling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just don't understand people who feel threatened by stuff like that. It's like, he's not telling you have to do it.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, don't tell him he can't, you know?
Uh-huh, just mind your own business.
I'm with you.
So, let me, I don't know if you want to talk about the Rokesby.
Sure. So the Rokesby series is actually the Bridgerton prequels. They're all out. The series is finished in English. They're in the middle of coming out in Spanish right now. And oh my gosh, the covers are so cute. I love the Spanish covers. And what happens, I think a lot of people thought I was going to write the Bridgerton sequels and write about, you know, the kids of the Bridgertons. And instead I went in the other direction. For a couple different reasons. One was I thought it would be really fun to have the Bridgerton parents as characters, not as main characters, but have them show up. And then I ended up not having them show up really till the last book, but they're there. And then also it's an interesting time period. It was a more interesting time period for me to work with. And so in fact, one of the books, I don't know what it's called in Spanish. In English, it's The Girl with the Make-Believe Husband. And that's actually set in New York, which I've never done before. Because it's during the Revolutionary War. So the characters are British, but the main male character, Edward, is a soldier in the British Army and he's stationed in New York. And then the heroine, Cecilia, actually, she's also British. She comes to New York, she's looking for her brother. So I'd never done anything outside the UK before. So that was really fun for me, you know, very different. But it turned out to be really fun because by the end of the series, you see some of the Bridgerton characters as young children. So okay. Anthony and Benedict are young boys. I think they're maybe 7 and 5. And Colin is a baby. And I had so much fun writing those scenes, to take these characters who we've all met as adults and be like, what would they be like as little kids, you know? And I just enjoyed it so much. I mean, it's still all about the love story, don't get me wrong, but you know, they did kind of steal the show a little bit.
And how has been your research? Because you're, I mean, I imagine you have to look, I don't know, in the local library, or did you go crazy? Like I'm going to go to that library and so on and get the...
Well, I mean, so a lot of the research, there's a lot of stuff I just know by now. I've been writing in this time period since the mid 90s. So a lot of it I just know.
Okay.
But you know, you always have to look things up as you go along. So for example, in the third book in the Rokesby series, The Other Miss Bridgerton, a lot of it takes place on a ship. And that's when I realized I don't know anything about sailing ships. You know, it's all of a sudden you start writing and I'm like, I know nothing. And that's when you suddenly start doing a lot of research. And so I'm like, and then all of a sudden I'm thinking, who knew there were so many different type of tall sail ships? And then part of it was set in Lisbon. And so suddenly I started doing all this research. I was like, oh, I knew nothing about Portugal. And just, you start realizing what you don't know as you go along. And so that's really fun. And you definitely do, it's an expression in English. I don't know if you have it in Spanish. Go down a rabbit hole.
No.
Okay.
I get it.
It's basically when you start doing something and you just can't stop, and you're just like stuck in there, and you'll be like researching something, and 2 hours has gone by, and you realize you've spent the last 2 hours trying to figure out the name of cross streets in Lisbon in 1783. You know, and wow, what a building would look like, and you're just, I didn't have time for that. And you realize you didn't even need that much detail, but you just kind of can't stop.
And how do you manage your time, and how much time you're going to, your time with the your deadline with the publishers, and the time when you just say, you know what, I need a week to look for the different kinds of medicines, or I don't know about,
well,
the remedies that they use.
Yeah, it doesn't really kind of, for me at least, it doesn't really work like that, because I just look up as I go along and as I need it. It's not really setting, so it's kind of all interspersed. My bigger problem is that I just take off too much time between projects. And then, so that's my bigger problem. I'm not.
But you need the spaces, no?
Yes, but I probably don't need as much as I take. And this past year, I've taken off actually a lot of writing time, in part because I've been very busy, you know, doing stuff like this, and with the show coming out, but also with COVID. My husband's a physician, he's a doctor of infectious diseases. Oh. So I know it's been
a hero.
Really hero. I think so. I've spent a lot, I think a lot of my energy has been really spent just supporting my family and being there for my family during a really tough time. And then Bridgerton came out. And so I've been taking quite a break, and I need to get back to work soon.
No, but I mean, it's not like you're a lazy author, so.
No, I don't think so. No. I mean, I've written almost
30 books. I feel bad for your time, for your break time. And I want to know about your literary loves. Tell us what are like 5 books that change your life, or anyone really that you like.
I have one here. Shoot, I finally cleaned up the area back here and I moved the books. 5 books that changed my life. Oh dear.
Oh, so since you were young, you can probably think.
Well, I'll start with like a romance novel. So I hope she's in Spanish, Lisa Kleypas. She wrote, well, 2 books. It's a 2-book series. In English, it's Then Came You and Dreaming of You. And I read them as I was writing my first book and was just so blown away by how great they were. It just really inspired me to keep going. And now she's my friend. So that's really
exciting. Wow.
Another book I just adore is called The Last Days of Summer by Steve Kluger.
Mm-hmm.
And it is an epistolary novel. So it's written all in letters and telegrams and like programs from the theater. And that book is set in the early 1940s in Brooklyn, New York. And it's just, it's so funny. And it's also completely heartbreaking. And I love that one. Oh, A Prayer for Owen Meany by John Irving, which I think is pretty famous all around the world. I read that one on vacation. And I can bring this back to Bridgerton. So I actually wasn't on vacation. I was working. When I was 20 years old, I worked as a travel writer in Greece. Mm-hmm. And I don't speak any Greek, so I don't know why they sent me there. But at some point, I was just desperate, and I was at a hotel, and they had a little lending library, and that book was there, and I picked it up because it was the only book in English, and I read it, and it was amazing. And it's one of these things where, you know, so much is happening, and then at the end, you think, how is this all going to come together? And then it does. And so it's incredible. But however many years later, the story goes that Shonda Rhimes discovered my books because she was on vacation. And she ran out of books, just like I ran out of books. And somehow she picked up one of my books. I actually don't know what the first one she picked up was. But she picked up one of my books. And so my life is completely changed because Shonda didn't bring enough books on her vacation.
I remember the story. It has to do a little bit with you, of how Alexander Hamilton, the Broadway play, got made because Lin-Manuel didn't know what to read. He ran out of books. And in the airport, the only thing that he could find was the biography of Alexander Hamilton. Yeah, those moments are really good.
It is really good. But, you know, and people have said to me, you know, other authors, how did you sell your book to Hollywood? And I'd say, I didn't. I just got lucky. I got really lucky, like really, really, really lucky. So these things happen. They absolutely do. I mean.
And what are you reading right now? What's your interest?
What am I reading right now? I'm kind of not reading anything at this very moment.
On December or the last book that you finished.
Last book that I finished. Well, I'll tell you what I'm reading next. Lizzie and Dante by Mary Bly.
Okay.
And I'm really excited because Mary Bly is the real name of Eloisa James, who's a romance writer. And this is the first book that she's written under her own name. Because it's a little bit different. It's not really a romance, it's more general fiction. Mm-hmm. And I'm super excited to read it. It's set in Italy, and Mary goes to Italy all the time because her husband is Italian. And so I know it's going to just make me want to travel. But that's the next one I'm reading.
That's really good. And any novel like Jane Austen and so on from that period?
You know, I mean, I love Jane Austen, but I think people think because they have romance in them that they're not hard reads. They actually are hard to read.
Oh, they are.
I'm just not personally a big fan of reading stuff from long ago. I don't enjoy it as much as reading more modern literature. Just the way that the sentence is put together, it's hard work.
And they're tragedies, no?
Well, not the Austen, but a lot of them are tragedies. Yeah, I just like to read the modern stuff more often. That's just me.
Oh, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. I this was so much fun. And, you know, I miss traveling so much, so it's so nice to be able to talk to people all around the world.
I know. It's not the same, but at least we were able to communicate somehow and just pay tribute to your beautiful work.
Those covers are so nice.
We're really happy that your work has found so many readers around the world. Mm-hmm. I'm happy that you're happy, and let's keep that message going. Like you don't have to even read all the time tragic stories. We have a crazy world as it is. We don't need more depressive things. And yeah, the thrillers and so on, they're fun sometimes, but I mean, you should invent a new genre.
I just think it's nice. I mean, I want to read a book that when I finish, I'm happy. I mean, not every book, you know, I, as I said, we don't need all books to be like that, but I think we need to value the books that you close and you're smiling. You know, if a book makes you laugh and it makes you smile when you close it and you feel good, that's important. I think we need more of that.
Yeah. And the TV producers and movie producers and the editors and so on should think a little bit more of that. Even the new generations probably will ask for more of that.
I hope so. I hope so.
Thank you again.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Si deseas ver la entrevista con subtítulos, la puedes encontrar en el canal de YouTube Revista Le Más de Librerías Gandhi.
Le Más es la revista oficial de Librerías Gandhi, la cual la puedes adquirir en todas nuestras librerías a nivel nacional. No te olvides además que si ese mes se te fue comprar un número o quieres otro ejemplar, puedes ingresar en revistalemás.mx o gandhi.com.mx para adquirir los números anteriores por 25 pesitos.
En 2009, una revista recién nacida, con portada de Marilyn Monroe, salió de la imprenta por primera vez. Han pasado 15 años de libros, entrevistas, encuentros, arte, cultura e historia. Esta es la única publicación de divulgación cultural en México que ha creado una red con las casas editoriales alrededor del mundo para ofrecer a nuestros lectores novedades literarias y entrevistas internacionales. Así que brindemos por muchos años de Lee Más, para que lectores, editores y escritores continuemos con este diálogo infinito. Durante estos 15 años, el equipo de Lee Más hemos descubierto nuestra verdadera vocación. Nunca se ha tratado de enseñar desde una posición de superioridad, sino de compartir lo que amamos, la chispa de autenticidad que encontramos en cada historia. Por eso, elegimos la compasión como tema para festejar nuestro aniversario, pues la bondad, transformada en identificación con los demás, nos ha guiado para no perder el rumbo y para hablar de los temas que valen la pena. En este número especial de aniversario, exploramos la compasión en la literatura, el arte y el cine de la mano de José Luis Trevalara, Aura Cruz Aburto, Mariana García Luna, Erles Velasco, Gilberto Díaz y Mariana Aguilar. Además, entrevistamos al escritor Julio Rojas, que nos ofreció sus hipótesis acerca de cómo recuperar la humanidad que nos queda. Fernando Hernández Urías escribió acerca de una serie que nos encanta por su propuesta de cambiar al mundo a través de la bondad, Ted Lasso. Incluimos además un póster de nuestro querido Alejandro Magallanes por nuestro cumple y una portada doble con nuestra querida Marilyn y su fiel amigo Truman. No nos queda sino agradecer a nuestros colaboradores, a las personas que han formado parte de este equipo en cada etapa, a los directivos de Gandhi, por creer en nosotros y a nuestros amados lectores, por supuesto que también. Sin todos ustedes, este proyecto no sería posible. Gracias por acompañarnos durante estos 15 años y consigan este número en librerías Gandhi, gandhi.com.mx y revistaleemas.mx y bailemos el vals con la quinceañera.
Bueno amigos, pues ya terminamos y la próxima semana vamos a escuchar la entrevista que le hicimos recientemente a Julia, pero yo creo que sí era importante tener las dos entrevistas en conjunto porque te da un sentido también de evolución y son dos entrevistas con dos atmósferas muy diferentes e igual de apreciables, igual de lindas porque Julia es maravillosa. Así que compren sus libros en Editorial Urano. Nos escuchamos la próxima semana, que además va a haber una sátira de Bridgerton, entonces va a estar padre. Que estén muy bien.